Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And this time we begin the TechNet, as we do most Sunday evenings, starting at 8 o'clock. And for those who sign in the beginning, we try very hard to, those who sign in with a question or a comment, we try very hard to at least give them a brief answer by 9 or 9:15, 9:30 in that order, so that a person in theory doesn't have to wait much more than an hour to get an answer. Beyond that, Paul, WS2N, tells us what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. John, KC2, WGB, tells us what the new hams are asking for questions, the guys that don't have a license yet and don't have a way of talking to us directly. The TechNet is a live audio exchange. In other words, the majority of what takes place on the TechNet, the so-called education that attempts to be conveyed, is done verbally, not as a written free consulting service. After John, Paul, and I finished the normal TechNet materials, the three things I just mentioned to you, then we go into the deeper material. And the deeper material, we know ahead of time, doesn't appeal to everybody, but be forewarned ahead of time. If it's something that doesn't please you, you have 800 other channels on that 10-meter rig to tune to, if you know what I mean. And there's also a volume control. There are people who insist on having control of what takes place, and therefore they want to control what subjects are being discussed. As long as the subject itself is not damaging to human beings, it's not obscene or whatever, if it's a subject of interest to ham radio operators, if it's of interest to the scientific mind portion of ham radio operators, I think it's appropriate for the TechNet. The questions that are allowed to be on the TechNet are kind of far and wide of any subject of interest to ham radio operators. Now, because we've had a convention that took place today in Levittown, the Limark Flea Market, as some people call it, but it has other names, and I think there were people who bought and sold some interesting things. We should hear some stories about that. We also have heard that a volunteer examinations took place and some successes took place where people have a higher class license. We're going to be hearing about those things. So it should be kind of fun. The majority of what the TechNet does, we try to convey information, education. There are 26 kinds of ham radio. Each of them have got a fair amount of complication. Wireless technology is a little bit complicated, but it can be a whole lot of fun. You'll learn it step by step by talking to people who are doing it. Talking to people who are doing it and doing it yourself in your own basement, backyard, tower, rooftop, chimney mount, whatever, a pole alongside of the house to support the antenna. When you do it with your own hands, build the kit, test the circuit, follow somebody else's schematic, make variations of your own, that's the learning process. For people who think I know a fair amount about electronics because of my 40 years of experience in the area of wireless technology. In reality, in the beginning, I passed my general class license by pure memorization of an awful lot of the material. I didn't understand it at the time when I was 16 years of age. Me and a buddy just memorized the license guide at the time, passed the test. We used to have to memorize schematic diagrams of transmitters and receivers and reproduce those as a written diagram as part of the examination that took place in front of the FCC office in New York City. Things have changed quite a bit since then with the multiple choice questions. Okay, a person signs into the technical net because he wants to tap into that brain power that exists in the New York City area by asking us a question or a comment, and you do that by giving us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KD2BHY/AG, Jim, and yes. That's the way a sign-in might take place. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2GJE, Ed, for the comment.
We got you, Ed. Who else?
Yes.
Okay, that was a quadruple, but the last person I heard was Jim, so I'm pretty sure he was signing in. Is that true, Jim? KD2BHY?
That is true.
Okay, so we got Ed and Jim. Who are the other people who are signing in?
KC2WGB, comments on the fare.
N2HCN, transmission line. and comments on the third.
Okay, we've got Sean and Wes. Anyone else?
K to DUX. Yes.
Okay, is that K to Baker Uniform X-Ray? Correct me if I'm wrong, and tell me your name, sir.
Kilo Alpha 2, Papa Uniform X-Ray, and the name is Charles. Over.
Okay, we've got you, Charles. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check in at this time? Give me your call letters and name.
KDG, this is Chris. I have a question.
Okay, Chris, thank you. You gave me your name. And I think it's Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta Golf is what it sounded like. Please correct me, Chris.
Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Delta Golf.
Alpha Delta Golf. We got you this time, Charles. I think it's Charles. So you can correct me. Okay, let me make sure we've got those all properly numbered. We got more than enough to get started. Ed, 82 Golf, Juliet Echo. What was the flea market like for you, and what would you like to ask us? You've got it, Ed. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. No, I didn't make the flea market. I got a basement full of junk. Been listening to some of the discussions on SWR. I'd like you to add something to the public knowledge. You put the SWR bridge or directional coupler between the rig and the antenna tuner, and you adjust it for, say, a one-to-one. If you put another bridge between the antenna tuner and the antenna, you're still going to have an SWR there. And if you have a directional coupler, you might see 80 watts forward, 20 watts reverse. I'd like you to explain to the public that that 20 watts doesn't get lost. Over.
A darn good subject, Ed. And also, when Wes comes to asking his question about standing wave ratio, what really goes on the transmission line at times seems mysterious. Most of our modern-day no-tune rigs can't tolerate more than about a 1.5, 1.7 standing wave ratio before they either turn the transmitter off or start cutting back in power. They're very persnickety about how accurate is the 50 ohm impedance as the load of those transmitters. As such, we either buy an extra antenna tuner and put it on the outside, or buy the antenna tuner that goes inside, but we use an antenna tuner. You study what an antenna tuner is. It really is a kind of a filter. It really is, in many cases, a pi or an L filter, pi network. In other words, it's got a shunt capacitor, a series inductor, and another shunt capacitor. And in the old days, those two capacitors, they're variable capacitors. They used to be called the tuning control, the first capacitor, and the loading control, the second capacitor. So a pi network does a beautiful job of filtering just the right frequency you want to go through and impedance matching. Your antenna itself, if this is the most ideal world, your antenna is a pure 50 ohm resistor at your operating frequency. Almost no antenna we use comes close to meeting that. A pure half-wave dipole might be 70 ohms. That gives you a 1.3 standing wave ratio, because that's the ratio of 70 ohms to 50 ohms. If you've got it just the right length, so it's a pure resistor. Depending on how far you mount that dipole above the ground and you're getting some ground reflection, the resulting impedance of the antenna can easily be slightly capacitive, slightly inductive, because of the altitude you've mounted it at, even if it has exactly the right length. You can also make it capacitive by making the dipole a little bit too short, or inductive by making it too long. If, because you've mounted it at a particular altitude above the ground, it's become capacitive and inductive, and you can find out which it is by either trial and error, or by using an antenna tuner, an antenna analyzer, or there's various ways you can find out what is the exact impedance of the antenna. If it's slightly inductive or capacitive because the particular length you've mounted it above the ground, you can correct that by readjusting the length. So the half-wave dipole in free space might be a little bit shorter or a little bit longer to be completely resonant in your environment because of the altitude you've measured it, mounted it at. But now getting to what Ed is telling us. That impedance of your antenna, which is less than perfect 50 ohm resistor, If it's got any reactants or any other number of resistive ohms, that signal that goes down the transmission line that hits the antenna, the persnickety characteristic between a transmission line and an antenna is that if the antenna is not exactly the right resistive number of ohms equal to the so-called characteristic impedance of the transmission line, in other words, a 300-ohm transmission line, you better put a 300-ohm resistor antenna at the far end of it, or a 50-ohm coax, you better put a 50-ohm dipole, for instance, at the far end, if you can do that. And if you don't meet that criteria, some amount of energy reflects back. That's the standing wave ratio starting event. Some amount of energy reflects back. You can fairly easily calculate exactly how much energy is going to flow back by using an equation. I'm going to admit to you that this equation, if you're not familiar with complex mathematics, it's going to throw you for a curve at first. But you take the real impedance of your antenna. If by some magic you know what it is, you use an antenna analyzer and you find out your antenna is a 70-ohm resistor in series with a 10-ohm capacitor, for instance. That might be the real impedance of your antenna. Let's call that ZA, the Z of the antenna. And the formula is ZA minus 50 ohms divided by ZA plus 50 ohms. You do that in complex mathematics where the ZA, the antenna, is open parentheses 70, 10 in my example. That's a 70-ohm resistor in series with a 10-ohm inductor, close parentheses. And now you add, you subtract 50 ohms from what's on the denominator. You put the same ZA in the bottom, and you add 50 ohms to it. Now you've got an equation in complex mathematics. You solve that equation, and it tells you exactly the magnitude of the reflection. By the way, that equation tells you reflection coefficient as a complex voltage, complicated.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You carry out that reduction of that complicated numerator and denominator. You actually divide one into the other, so to speak, by a bunch of procedures in complex mathematics. You bring that down to an amplitude and a phase angle. The amplitude is the amount of reflected voltage that your antenna is creating when being fed with that particular transmission line. And it has a phase angle, depending on whether the antenna is an inductor, which means you'll get a delayed phase angle of reflection, or a capacitor, if you'll get an advanced phase angle, if the resistive component is greater than 50 ohms, and opposite if the resistive component is less than 50 ohms, in my example. So you can calculate exactly what amplitude and phase angle will be reflected back from the antenna. And that formula tells you the complex voltage, amplitude and phase, of what's reflected. That's the beginning of the standing wave ratio process. If you want to know the amount of power being reflected, you know that the absolute power is a function of voltage squared, and in the case of complex mathematics, it's a little bit more complicated. But that voltage can be converted into a power. You, with your Bird watt meter, the Bird watt meter, for instance, that you mount after the antenna tuner in the transmission line, let me drop. You can read the forward power your transmitter is sending down the line. Because the antenna is imperfect, there's some amount of power being reflected. And that power meter in the reverse mode, your Bird watt meter, when you flip the slug backwards, will tell you exactly how much power is reflecting back. When you adjust your antenna tuner so that that crazy impedance that's presented in the shack end of the transmission line, which is not going to be in general 50 ohms resistor, you readjust the tuning and loading control either by a manual process or an automatic process in your antenna tuner, and now the transmitter will see pure 50 ohms. The Bird watt meter you put between the transmitter and the antenna tuner, as Ed was telling us, it will see, if you've got a 100-watt transmitter, it'll see 100 watts going forward, it'll see 0 watts going back, or if you put an antenna analyzer there, it'll see a 50-ohm resistor. And that's what your antenna tuner does for you. The antenna, the Bird watt meter that's in the transmission line will see no change in VISWAR as you adjust the antenna tuner. The VISWAR is a function of what is the load at the end of the transmission line. You didn't change that. You could change it by putting the antenna tuner up at the top of the tower, so to speak. Very few of us do that and remotely tune it. You could if you want to. In general, you don't have to. You get 95% of the performance when you have an antenna tuner properly tuned in the shack. So now, the antenna tuner in the shack takes that complicated impedance of your antenna after that length of transmission line, and by the way, by way of a Smith chart, knowing how many wavelengths long your transmission line is, if your antenna happened to be, in my example, a 70-ohm resistor and a 10-ohm inductor in series with each other, you'd like to think that in the shack end of the transmission line, if it was low-loss transmission line, you'd see 70 ohms of resistor and 10 ohms of inductor. In general, the answer is no. The craziness, another craziness of a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Another craziness of a transmission line. By the way, I should mention the fact that anybody who's listening tonight who wants to sign in by Echolink, I've been told that the Echolink that's normally linked to the Eastern N repeater, the 147.375, which I think is called, I can't remember the call letters of that repeater now. The W2VL repeater is the main one we're using, and that's the one you have to go to with your Echolink, the 147.375. What's the call letters of that one? And I think the Echolink on that one is not operating tonight. Can someone correct me on that one? Okay, there. What we were told earlier is they're working on it, that the Echolink on the Eastern repeater, which is linked to the Western repeater, the W2VL one, the Eastern repeater Echolink is not working tonight. You have to sign into the other one until they fix it. We hear tell that they're working on it, and maybe in the next hour or so that'll all become operational. So a person out of the area trying to sign in by Echolink has to know to sign into the other machine, and also one of the best-kept secrets is that the timing is such that we all should wait for all four beeps in between each transmission to make sure all the system becomes reset. Well, quite often we get excited, we talk on top of each other, and therefore there is a method by which you can, the normal writing mode, so to speak, you can write the word break, B-R-E-A-K, and the system will voice synthesize your call letters and let everyone know that you're trying to get through, even though we haven't done the timing correctly. So there's a whole learning curve to get the maximum performance out of the Echolink or IRLP system. But now getting back to Ed's original question, another crazy thing about transmission line is depending on the length of the transmission line, if it happened to be exactly a odd number, let me think now, is it odd or even? Any number of half wavelengths long, exactly a half wavelength long, or a multiple of a half wavelength long, at the velocity factor of the cable, if the cable is that magic length, then and only then, if it's a low-loss cable, whatever impedance the antenna is presenting at the far end of the cable is the exact same impedance you'll see at the near end of the cable. But for other lengths of cable, an odd number of quarter wavelengths, by the way, what I just described to you before, equal impedance, some number of half wavelengths, one half wavelength, two half wavelengths, three half wavelengths. If it's some exact number of half wavelengths electronically, it repeats the impedance. It's just one of the crazy characteristics you have to memorize as to how our transmission line behaves. If it's an odd number of quarter wavelengths, quarter wave, three-quarter wave, five-quarter wave, and so on, an odd number of quarter wavelengths, it does an impedance inversion. Put a 25-ohm resistor on there, which is half of 50 ohms, at the far end of the cable, a quarter wavelength of cable, or an odd number of quarter wavelengths of cable, does an impedance inversion, and so the 25-ohm of my second example, which is half the impedance of the 50-ohm cable, means that it's a 2-to-1 ratio. Impedance inversion means that on the input end of the quarter wavelength of cable, you'll measure 100 ohms. It's still a 2-to-1 ratio, but it now is doubled the impedance instead of halving it. That's what we mean by impedance inversion. If you know the exact length of your cable, and you make the right kind of a measurement in the shack with an antenna analyzer, it's almost as good as climbing to the top of the tower and putting the antenna analyzer right at the antenna. There are ways you can calibrate your cable. That's what a network analyzer does in the calibration procedure. You can calibrate...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You can calibrate your cable and therefore know exactly what your antenna impedance is. It's sometimes academic, sometimes it's good to know. If the antenna happened to be slightly capacitive, you know that electronically the antenna, if it's a dipole, is a little bit too short, and you know the length of it. Add a clip lead or twist another length of wire at the end of the cable and hang it off to beyond the insulator, if you know what I mean. Or if it's inductive, you know it's a little bit too short. Fold over some of the wire or cut away some of the wire. So knowing the impedance of the antenna tells you which way to go. You don't have to know that, but it's just one very nice way of doing it. I told you about impedance inverting for a quarter wavelength of cable. In between quarter wavelength and half wavelength of cable, it does something else. It's really walking around a particular circle of a particular diameter on the Smith chart. The diameter of the circle tells you how much standing wave ratio there is. And when it comes to impedance inverting, in the first example I gave of an antenna that's 70 ohms of resistor and 10 ohms of inductance, when you invert that, do you get the inversion of 70 ohms of resistor and the 10 ohms of inductor? Yes, but it's a little bit more complicated. The Smith chart will help you, and if you know how to invert impedance on a handheld calculator that can handle calculated complex arithmetic, and the HPs can do it, you'll know. But the main question Ed now asked us, of the power that's reflected back from the antenna, where does it go? You ask that question of most of your fellow ham radio operators. You go on the 80-meter band or the 20-meter band some afternoon, and you ask them, where does all that reflected power go? A significant percentage of those guys will say that antenna tuner is phony. It just takes all that reflected power and throws it away. They think that's happening because on the input end of the antenna tuner, where they put their bird watt meter, they see no reflected power. Therefore, they're convinced the antenna tuner just threw it away, and it's wasting it. Well,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
What we're calling power is really a rate of the transmitter generating energy. If it generated 1 watt of power, that really means it's generating 1 joule of energy every second. That's what 1 watt is. A watt second, a joule is a newton meter, is a watt second. A joule is a watt second. If your transmitter was generating 1 watt, that really means it's generating 1 joule of energy every second. 1 joule of energy every second, we call that 1 watt. The reflected power from the antenna is real energy. You can put a calibrated directional coupler. You can sample that reflected power. You can light a light bulb with it. To me, that's real. You'd be amazed how many people will say, that's only reactive power. It's not real. But what does the antenna tuner do with it? You can't get rid of energy or power in a continuous manner without either radiating it or converting it into heat or bouncing it, so to speak. Of that energy coming back from the antenna, I guarantee that the antenna tuner, if it's a good one, does not convert it into heat. You can run your antenna tuner with 100 watts of input, key down for 10 minutes, and if it's a good one, it runs ice cold. It's not dissipating the energy as heat. If it's well made and it's well shielded, it is not radiating it because it's a completely shielded box. And the coax cable going in and coming out is completely shielded. It can't be radiating it. There's only one thing left. Got to obey the law of conservation of energy. Real energy, real power is being reflected back from the antenna toward the antenna tuner. It re-reflects it forward. When you thought you were adjusting the tuning and loading control, if you were doing it manually on your antenna tuner, and you thought you were correcting the crazy impedance of your antenna plus feed line so that the antenna, so the transmitter saw a pure 50 ohm resistor. Let me drop. You did an impedance matching operation. You thought that's what you were doing, just impedance matching. You didn't realize it. Mother Nature simultaneously was doing something else. That pure impedance matching, where your antenna tuner must obey the conservation of energy rules, it is taking every bit of that reflected energy from the antenna back down to the shack, re-reflecting it forward. Every bit of it is re-reflected forward.
KB2NGU, this is KC2IHI, over.
The company I'm working for most of the time, my main client, is going through a development of a product where they need more of my time than they normally do. So there are two battles that I'm fighting simultaneously. I have to go to work the next day. I'm fighting a battle at home as well as a battle at the company where the real cash flow comes from. So for the time being, the TechNet has to be 4 hours worth and has to stop at midnight if it's going to be run by me. Now, if you other guys want to go beyond that, that's something else. But for the time being, for the next couple of months, until I get out from under this reasonably tough situation. I'm the person that requested that it stop at midnight, Wes, and I know that I didn't make that clear. I was afraid that various people wouldn't accept it, and so, as I said, I made that request. Now, let me give you a couple of words on the subject of coaxial cable with standing wave ratio. Let me drop. One of the things the books do not make clear is what does a standing wave ratio really look like? First of all, it's something that's moving at the speed of light, and therefore understanding it, making measurements are kind of difficult. Here's my way of looking at it. If I first had the ability to stop time, a signal was flowing down a cable, and I could stop time, and I'm able to walk over to the cable, whether it be twin lead or coax cable, and make a bunch of measurements. So I take my voltmeter out, and I measure the voltage along the cable, whether I'm measuring from center conductor to outer conductor, if it's a coax cable, or whether I'm measuring the voltage between the two lines, if it's a twin lead. And so I've stopped the time, I've stopped the wave that was flowing down the cable, and I walk over there and make measurements. And I make a measurement at the beginning of the cable, I move an inch down range, make another measurement, I move another inch down range, make another measurement, and I make this into a graph. I plot the graph. I'm measuring the voltage, polarity, and magnitude. And I plot it as a horizontal graph, where the graph, the horizontal axis represents the distance along the cable, and maybe I make the graph full size. Maybe the graph is 1 inch on the graph versus 1 inch on the cable. And up and down, the deflection on the graph is the voltage magnitude. And I go along that graph, and I'm along that cable where I stop time, and I make all of those measurements. I get a whole bunch of dots on the curve, and I connect all those dots with a smooth line. I would see a beautiful sine wave going down that cable. Sine wave of stopped action of voltage versus position. I now allow time to flow forward for a fraction of a microsecond, and I stop the time again, and I repeat the measurements. My first set of measurements, I made them with a black pencil on the graph. And now, a fraction of a microsecond downrange in time, I stop time again, and I go back and make the exact same measurements. And I plot all the red dots on the same graph, and I connect them all with a straight line.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Your first question is going to ask, let me drop for long enough. The sine wave I drew at zero time, and the sine wave that I drew a fraction of a microsecond later, would be the exact same sine wave, except the sine wave is now shifted to the right by an amount of distance that represents that delta in time and the speed of light. The signal is traveling down the cable at the speed of light if the cable was air-filled. And if it was filled with polyethylene, it's going to flow 66% of the speed of light. And that's calculatable. Once you know the dielectric constant of the material, you know how much the signal could slow down. But if it was an air-filled cable or an air-filled twin lead, it would be at the speed of light. So if I allowed the time to flow 1 nanosecond and then stopped it again, and the speed of light is very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. So I allowed time to flow forward for 1 nanosecond, and I stopped time, and I made these measurements. I'd get the exact same graph of sine wave on that curve, except everything would be shifted to the right. The red dots and that sine wave would be shifted to the right 1 foot because I've allowed time to flow for 1 nanosecond compared to the black dots, which was at T0. So now you get a little bit of a feeling for voltage versus position versus time along a cable when a normal signal is flowing down the cable from the input end of the transmission line and it's going down toward the load, which could be the antenna. Let me drop. Now, assuming I've got a fairly poor match at the far end, it could be a short circuit, it could be an open circuit. Let's make it an open circuit. An open circuit end of the cable means that all the signal arrives there, sees the open circuit, and then all of that energy has nowhere to go. There's no load out there, and therefore it's all got to reflect back. And again, I stop time, and by some magic, I can keep track of the forward flowing waveform, which was the black and red curve that I drew before, and the reverse flowing waveform. Maybe I draw it in blue. By some magic, I can keep track of the blue waveform, the one that's flowing back. And that blue waveform will flow back at the exact same speed. It'll be a beautiful-looking sine wave. You won't be able to tell the difference between the forward-flowing sine wave and the reverse-flowing sine wave. One happens to be the mirror image of the other, but you don't know that per se. It'll be a beautiful looking blue sine wave flowing to the left at the speed of light. Because you've got some sine waves flowing to the right, that's the black and red ones, and you've got these blue ones flowing to the left, there are certain key positions on the cable where when the red curve or the blue black curve hits a peak, the blue curve flowing back hits a peak at the exact same spot at the exact same time. That's the place where the standing wave has the greatest amount of voltage. If this was a twin lead electrowire like system and you put your neon bulb or your voltage measuring device across the two wires, you would get maximum brilliance at that point. If you could see the voltage on that point, very similar to looking at a guitar string that you've plucked and you're looking at it with a magnifying glass, let me drop. You would see the maximum deflection of the guitar string at the point where the standing wave is the maximum. With your voltmeter, you make voltage measurements. You would see twice the voltage, but believe it or not, if there was a pure open circuit at the end, the voltage doubles at that point and flows backwards. Or it's actually the same voltage flowing backwards, but because when you choose the points where the voltage is maximum, you're looking at the forward-going voltage and the reverse-going voltage, and because those voltages add, you'll get twice voltage. If I had 1 volt of black and red wave flowing to the right before and a pure open circuit, I'm going to get 1 volt of blue wave flowing backwards, and if I choose the right spot where the red wave and the blue wave add up, I'm going to measure 2 volts. 2 volt of RF frequency. At the point where the voltage is maximum, it is going up and down at the carrier rate. If it was a 1 megacycle signal I'm sending down that cable, the voltage maximum and minimum, the place where the voltage is maximum, you look at that point, it's like the guitar string moving up and down with the maximum deflection. It's going positive and negative in voltage, just like the guitar string goes up and down in deflection. I would see 2 volts of up and down signal at that point, maximum voltage at that point. And in the case of a perfect standing wave, a infinite standing wave ratio of infinity, in other words, the voltage is maximum at one point and absolute zero at another point, a quarter wave away, because I've made a perfect open circuit on a low-loss cable, at the point where the voltage is maximum, the current is zero. It's hard to believe, but take my word for it. And at the place where, if I move a quarter wave to the right or to the left of where the voltage is maximum, I will see minimum voltage, but maximum current. Whatever the current was flowing down the cable when there was only one signal flowing, the current is now double. I'll see twice the amount of current at the points where the voltage is zero. Of course that sounds crazy. And when you multiply voltage...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A naive person will choose a place where there's a very high standing wave ratio, where the voltage is maximum and the current is zero. He will multiply the twice normal voltage times zero current and say the power there must be zero. Not true. That's a wrong way of looking at it. Or if I move a quarter wave to the right or to the left, and I look at the place where the voltage is zero but the current is twice normal, I got twice normal current times zero voltage, it looks like the power is zero there also. And in between, I'll measure intermediate values. In reality, what's happening is that there is a real black and red signal flowing to the right. It's got a real instantaneous voltage, a real instantaneous current. It's a real traveling wave. It's got real energy, real power, you could say, flowing to the right. The blue wave that's reflected is flowing to the left, and it's got real voltage and energy. Those waves on the cable itself, the wave flowing to the right and the wave flowing to the left, the cable itself keeps those two waves separate. The cable, you could say, doesn't know that there are two waves. It just knows that some energy is flowing down there. It doesn't mix them together. When you placed your voltmeter across the two wires at the place where the voltage is maximum, you are now using a non-directional power sensing device. Your simple voltmeter across the two wires simultaneously is looking at the forward flowing wave, simultaneously looking at the reverse flowing wave, and at that position on the cable, the two add together in a constructive manner, and I see a great big voltage. The current that really is flowing to the right and the current that's really flowing to the left at that point, they happen to cancel each other destructively at the point where the voltage is maximum, so that my current meter at that point will think it's seeing zero current. Well, my current meter, again,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
My current sensing meter is a non-directional device. It, for the first time, because I've added that instrumentation to this cable in this thought experiment we're talking about right now, because I've added this instrumentation which is non-directional, and it is itself mixing together the forward flowing wave and the reverse flowing wave, and therefore we see this thing called standing wave. Is the standing wave really there? Now you're getting into a difficult discussion. As far as the cable is concerned, no. There is a forward flowing wave and a reverse flowing wave, and they do not mix on the cable. If I used my Bird wattmeter slug, which is a directional detector, when it's in the forward sensing mode, it measures power going up the cable. When I take that slug and rotate it in the reverse flowing mode, it shows energy flowing in the reverse direction. If I used that power sensing device, I picked up the slug of a Bird wattmeter, and I'm using it at the frequency range where it's rated, and I slide that power sensing device along the cable, which has an open circuit at the far end, which has an infinite standing wave ratio. The voltage maximum over the voltage minimum is 2 volts divided by 0 volts. It's infinity. That's an infinite standing wave ratio because I've created a perfect open circuit at the far end. But I'm using this Bird directional coupler detector, the slug out of a Bird wattmeter. I'm sliding it along the cable. I will not see a standing wave ratio. I will see 1 volt of forward flowing power, whether I put it 1 inch down the cable, 1 foot down the cable, or 50 feet down the cable. I'll see the exact same voltage continuously flowing down that cable in the forward mode. I then reverse my Bird wattmeter slug, and I measure the reverse going power, and I move along the cable. It will be constant versus position. Use a
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you can literally do that experiment. You can literally build a directional detecting device that you put down the slot of a slotted line, the Hewlett-Packard 805, I think is the model number of a slotted line. You could put a directional detecting device down that line, even though you know you've created a very high standing wave ratio with a perfect short circuit or a perfect open circuit at the far end, and you're putting a signal generator at the input end, and with that directional detecting device, you slide it along the slotted line, and you'll see constant power going forward. You'll see constant power going backwards in every position along the line. But you put a simple piece of wire down there as a probe, a non-directional probe, and that's what the carriage on the Bird 805 slotted line does. It, for the first time, mixes together the forward flowing wave and the reverse going wave. Now they add together in certain positions constructively, a quarter wavelength away. They add together destructively. And so in the constructive positions, you'll see 2 volts in my example. In the destructive positions, you'll see 0 volts because you, with your instrumentation, are mixing the two together. Craziness, of course. Transmission lines have got a lot of funny characteristics. But the standing wave is a wave that is moving at the carrier rate. If I'm putting a 1 megacycle signal down there, that standing wave is moving up and down at the voltage maximum point at 1 megacycle rate. It's really the constructive waveform that happens from a forward-flowing wave and a reverse-flowing wave. The first time anyone hears this jazz explains transmission line theory and standing wave ratio theory, yes, it doesn't make sense. Yes, it seems opposite of common sense. It seems a little bit crazy. You have to hear it a number of times. There are very few books that make it very clear, in my opinion. Maybe this helps a little bit. I know you're going to have some more questions on this one, Wes, because this is not a simple subject. Transmission line theory.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The main guy that's running the electrical engineering department that repairs all the instrumentation at the Great Big Optical Observatory in La Salina, Chile. This is the European Southern Observatory. And his name is... Mortenwig is his last name. All of a sudden, I'm in trouble thinking of his first name. ZA5. Can't even think of his call letters right now. Anyhow, he and I have had some real serious arguments about what is standing wave ratio on a cable. some of the buried coaxial cables that maintain their instrumentation occasionally get a rodent that chews through the cable, and they have to find the fault how many feet downrange, and they didn't have a time domain reflectometer available to them, and I was making some suggestions as to how they can make the measurements and what is a real standing wave ratio on a cable. Well, Mr. Mornhenweg and I had all kinds of emails flying back and forth trying to understand the theory of operation of transmission lines and what really happens when you get a short circuit in the middle of a cable. N2XJM. Don, good question, Wes. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Call from 3420.
Yeah, N2XJM. Before I go to the transmission line, I gotta have to express the opinion of others. The gentleman that came to me, he's 53 years old, and he said, there is a TechNet, and there are discussions on the repeater. I don't hear you guys any longer talking about the repeater, so I said, well, my understanding is that we are no longer allowed to talk technical issues over the repeater. Maybe it's wrong, but I would like to be corrected by the line mark. And he said, you know what, Wesley, I don't understand. How come somebody's going to tell me you don't eat the cookie? I'm 53 years old, I'm a father of three children, and somebody is stopping the repeater of action. The technique is one thing, but the ability to share information and share the knowledge is no longer there. 6 days a week, the repeater is on. One day, the repeater is off at 12 o'clock, during the time of the TechNet, when people have a fresh memories and fresh knowledge. It's like you get out of the university now, you're no longer allowed to talk about it because somebody shut you down. So, you know, those are the expressions that I've heard about it. There are plenty. I would say I spoke about 15 people who expressed their deep disappointment from the activity of LightMark right now. So let me go to the transmission lines.
Give it a rest.
Now let me make a couple of comments on this one, Wes. We serious people who are trying to understand the deep science of how a transmission line works, how an antenna works, how propagation works, how a transmitter works, we're going to have to admit to each other we are the minority of ham radio operators. We are the subculture. Make believe you are the president of an organization called LIMARC that has something like 400 dues-paying members, and only a certain percentage of those members have that deep interest. Maybe the majority does not have that deep an interest. But from their point of view, they are the dues-paying members that support the club. They are the majority. You and I and John and Glenn and Eric, we're the minority.
Yeah, but Dick, I don't understand one thing. There are 15 random chosen people, not even chosen, just people that I have met. And all of these people, when they saw me, oh, I recognize your voice, I recognize you, oh, okay, how you been or whatsoever, and then they expressed their disappointment. I didn't ask for that. So now you believe that there is a certain minority. By simple logic, could you estimate if we have got 15 randomly chosen people and all of them expressed, not even one was against, their opinion this way, how many people are interested with the TechNet or the discussion after the TechNet? And to XGM.
Wah.
The president of the club, though, Eric, I mean, Wes, has to obey what the majority desires. They're the dues-paying members. They are in command. It is their machine. The people with a deeper interest, because we gather among ourselves and because we think we represent the whole society, we are the oddballs. There's only one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. That's what? 0.2% of the population is a ham radio operator. Among the very serious microwave enthusiasts that I gather with on the microwave reflector, the WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, has a website which is called a microwave reflector. It's a listserv, and he's got about 400 people worldwide that gather there to discuss serious microwave ham radio. The guy's above 1,000 megs, and the Sirius ones are pursuing 241 gigahertz ham radio, and I'm not kidding, homebrew equipment. They are one ham radio, one Sirius microwave operator per 500 hams. That's one per quarter million in the general population. That's a real subculture. Now, what we've got going on here is nowhere near that drastic, but we are a subculture. As such, if you and I get on the machine at high noon on a Saturday afternoon when people are driving around in their automobile, and we decide to have a discussion for 2 solid hours on our favorite subject, an awful high percentage of the members of the club are going to become unhappy because they can't discuss among themselves where is the traffic jam today, if you know what I mean. So we have to slowly admit to each other, Wes, we are the minority.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. You're right. It is not about a Saturday. It is just about a complaint that if people...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Beep.
Yeah, the discontinuance of the TechNet for the time being at midnight is my request, Wes, because... I've got to go to work the next day.
Yeah, I'm sorry interrupting you. I'm not going to drag this subject. Dick, it is your request, I understand. But it's supposed to be a people choice of not talking after 12 o'clock, not mandatory decision, just shut down the conversation.
Yeah, there is another possibility here. Quite a few people consider Sunday the day of rest. They would like to not have to monitor the machine until the wee hours of the morning on Sunday. I've got a guess as to that is another contributing factor. So I think it's time we leave this particular subject. We've got a little bit more of an understanding. And yes, there is no ideal, there's no glamour fix on this one. To keep everyone happy, to keep the majority of the dues-paying members, they're the guys with the power. They own the machine. You could say they own the frequency, even though it's loaned to them by a frequency coordinating committee, the repeater selecting committee, if you know what I mean. So you got to slowly try to keep everyone happy. Yes, it's not easy, and it's a compromise. All of life is a compromise. But hang in there, Wes. We will get a chance to discuss these subjects. We will get a chance to get a slightly greater understanding of how this hardware works. And that's part of what ham radio operators are doing with this TechNet. We're trying to educate each other how Mother Nature really sets up these rules. And if you think we've got tough rules, think about the people at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, where they're trying to figure out at the molecular level and the subatomic level, what is Mother Nature telling them? Is there really a Higgs boson? Is there really a neutrino that travels 20 parts per million faster than the speed of light? They've got some serious problems. They've got some big arguments going on. And pure research of any kind is never easy. It's always a little bit frustrating, and it's part of what's going on. Now, when it comes to the standing wave, is it a little bit more clear now with my black and red diagram of that sine wave moving to the right and the blue diagram of the sine wave moving to the left when you've got a standing wave? And how periodic is that standing wave? In the case of a wave going to the right and a wave going to the left, when it drops across the two wires of a twin lead, you sense this periodic waveform that we call a standing wave. There are certain positions where there's a maximum deflection. A quarter wavelength away to the right and to the left is a place where there is no voltage. That's if you're plotting voltage. If we now plotted current, it's the exact opposite waveform. At the place where the voltage is maximum, the current is zero. At the place where the voltage is minimum, the current is maximum. So you got a sine wave of voltage, you got a sine wave of current. You could say they're out of phase with each other, but it's more than out of phase. At the place where one is maximum, the other is minimum, and that's what happens when you put your current sensing device or your voltage sensing device on this coaxial cable. You end up with this waveform, if you're plotting voltage, that we call standing wave. It repeats every half wave. So the voltage waveform repeats every half wave. The current waveform repeats every half wave. The voltage going up and down of the voltage waveform is moving at the carrier rate, the signal rate. The periodicity is half wave step and repeat waveform. And so the people who have made these measurements on a slotted line see this characteristic waveform, they recognize it, and by making measurements with a Hewlett-Packard 415 standing wave ratio meter on a Hewlett-Packard 805 slotted line, you can physically see, by moving that carriage and that probe, you see that standing wave. Now, you've got that standing wave. Let me drop. In the case of the long-range 60-cycle power transmission system, the grid that goes across the United States, operating at 60 cycles, there the waveform is a couple of thousand miles long. 60 cycles is once every 16.66 milliseconds, you're getting a sine wave, and you figure that out, I think it's 1,600 miles long or something like that is the wavelength. You really do have a standing wave, so to speak. You've got a wave moving down those cables at 60 cycles. It's a very big, very long wave, and it makes a difference. If you and I are connecting a grid between Michigan and New York State, for instance, where there's close to 1,000 miles of difference between the two, during the time that New York State has more power than Michigan, and we're supplying the power to them, they are getting the delayed waveform because they're almost 1,000 miles away. During the time that Michigan generates more power than New York State, and the power is flowing toward us, we are getting the delayed waveform. So when you come to adjusting that power grid, it's not only a matter of adjusting the voltages, depending on who is supplying the power and who is sinking the power today, the phase has to be adjusted accordingly. It gives you a little bit of a feeling for how difficult it is to properly set up the power grid system and to make it survive a momentary fault that might occur if a lightning strike happens in a particular area, arcs over an insulator, or breaks a particular cable, and now a hell of a lot more power than normal has to flow through a particular area. If you're not willing to have a computer program that has this all pre-planned, that you must black out this particular area when that particular cable fails, if you didn't plan on that ahead of time...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you didn't plan on that ahead of time, where you've got a self-protect procedure already aligned ahead of time, and if during the time that a particular major cable in Ohio fails, because it's a super hot day, a lot of power is flowing down the cable gets hot, the cable stretches, it expands because of the extra temperature expanded the cable, and the cable sagged lower and touched a series of trees, because those trees hadn't been properly trimmed ahead of time, and now the cable with 200 kilovolts on it arcs over to those trees and knocks out that particular cable, which happened in August of 2003 or 2004, and it knocked out a major cable carrying a hell of a lot of power during a critical time of the day on a hot summer day when a lot of air conditioners are playing, and all of a sudden the whole system hadn't been properly planned ahead of time, and everybody in the perimeter tried pouring power into that area to support that shorted cable, which they couldn't do. And therefore, they were all being asked to supply beyond their capability, and the whole system crashed, and a significant portion of the east coast of the United States went black because of one particular failure of one particular key cable. If the system had been properly planned ahead of time, they would have realized that, okay, that particular cable that failed was serving a particular community in Ohio. And if you're willing to disconnect that community and black out that particular cable and that particular community that has the failed cable, the rest of the system will survive. You try pouring all of that power into that short-circuited cable from the rest of the grid, and all of a sudden you create a major blackout, which went on for quite a significant number of hours of that day in August. And I remember where I was when it happened, and we all got sent home because the company could no longer run. So there are ways of controlling a grid, but that is a kind of a standing wave condition. If it...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So there are lots of transmission lines that are sending energy that has to be properly controlled in amplitude and phase. Your antenna tuner recreates, reconnects, compensates for the reactive component or the resistive component that's too high or too low of the load that you put on your particular transmission line. An antenna tuner properly used presents a lot of magic, and it's sad that we've now have to buy the antenna tuner as a separate item, because all of our transmitters in the old day used to contain that. A DX100 Heathkit transmitter, 1975 kit, if you know what I mean, a very popular kit in those days. It had a great big tuning and loading control and a Pi network in the output of the final tube, and that could match almost any impedance from probably 20 ohms to 180 ohms and all kinds of reactants by readjusting the tuning and loading control, because the antenna tuner was built in. In the modern day rigs, we wanted the rig to be more compact, we wanted it to be no tune, and they took out that Pi network. And now, as long as the load you put on the transmitter is very close to 50 ohms resistive, a VISWR of under 1.5 to 1 or better, then the no-tune transmitter works like a charm. But that's not the real world. A significant percentage of the real antennas we use on a real day don't have a standing wave ratio as low as 1.5 to 1. So now you need the antenna tuner. And now we buy the separate item that we add that used to be there. It reminds me, as you've heard me say a lot of times, of a not-so-scrupulous building contractor who sees this brand-new piece of land. He mows down all the trees. He takes away all the topsoil. He builds the house. He digs the foundation, builds the house, and then when the owner of the house moves in, he sells them back the topsoil and sells them back the landscaping to put the trees back. Had he done a real careful job...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Had he done a real careful job of planning where the house and the foundation is going to go and only remove the trees and the topsoil in that particular area, everybody would have been happier. Unfortunately now, he's got to take extra time to do that planning. He can't run his backhoe and his bulldozer around the property with as much ease of access when he adds all of those trees back, when he doesn't remove all the trees. So his life is a little bit more difficult, but look at the grief he creates downrange. You and I buy a piece of property, and if we go to the right kind of a building contractor, you can arrange to do it that way. You don't have to make the land temporarily into a desert just because you're building a house on your particular acre of land. So this antenna tuner jazz is a little bit of a repeat of that scenario from my point of view. Not everybody sees it that way, but that's the way I see it. So I wonder if the motion of a standing wave down that cable, a traveling wave to the right and a traveling wave to the left, which is reflected from the antenna, I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense. And once you understand the mathematics of your particular load, if by design or by measurement you find out that your particular antenna at the far end of that cable is not a 50 ohm resistor, it's a 70 ohm resistor in series with a 10 ohm inductor, that happens to be the particular impedance of your antenna, once you know what your antenna is, and you can either calculate it, measure it, there's all kinds of ways you can find out exactly what your antenna is doing in your particular location. Once you know that, there's a way you can calculate exactly what magnitude of signal is going to be reflected from the antenna due to standing wave ratio, and exactly what phase angle that signal is going to be reflected from the antenna is. It is all deterministic. If you're smart enough to be able to measure the antenna, you know how much antenna, how much signal reflects back, and at what phase angle it reflects back. In other words, it's as if the antenna is acting like a second signal generator, sending a signal back down that cable. And believe it or not, I've done that exact experiment. I have intentionally set up a standing wave by using signal generator number one on the left-hand side of the cable, setting up signal generator number two on the right-hand side of the cable, making sure the two signal generators are both synthesized and are both running from the same reference oscillator. So they are both on the exact same frequency and the exact same phase. And now I can adjust the amplitude of signal generator number one, I can adjust the amplitude of signal generator number two, and I can make measurements along that cable about what is the standing wave ratio, where are the peaks and where are the maximums and so on, and it does exactly that. So your antenna, when it's not properly matched and it's making a reflected signal, it really is as if it was a second signal generator sending an identical frequency signal back down that cable. Ain't that crazy? N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. Yeah, very.